taxman's taken all my dough and left me in my stately home, blazing on a sunny afternoon. And I can't
Whoa, my name is Tom.
Good Tom.
You're listening to the Quarter to Three movie podcast, where this week we will be discussing and spoiling the movie Dinner for Schmucks. Dinner for Schmucks. I am joined by Christian Marcinaski, I believe. Is that right?
It's better than Jobin.
I also have with me Kelly Wand. Kelly Wand, do you have a Dinner for Schmucks related tagline you could share with us this week?
I'm wet.
All right. That's a good tagline. We'll get back to that. But first, to make sure we run off anyone who hasn't seen it and is worried about spoilers, why don't you recount for us what exactly happens in the course of Dinner for Schmucks? Just clear up.
You mean a schmonopsis?
Let's have it. Yes.
Alright, here we go. So Paul Rudd is the stockbroker who works for Bruce Greenwood, and this other guy gets fired at his work, so to get a promotion he pitches this sweet-ass idea of selling radioactive lamps shaped like nukes from StarCraft, made by some Swiss guy, which is too important an idea to put him in charge of, so they give it to Ron Livingston. But to sew up the deal, he has to bring an idiot to a dinner party, which is how I helped Tom get his fidget gig.
Very good.
Thank you. So he hits Steve Carell with his car. Not that most people don't like it. And then Steve Carell's totally unhurt because it's a comedy. And he stuffs mice and dresses them as America's greatest historical figures, like Jesus and Paul Rudd and Ben Franklin. And Paul Rudd keeps proposing to his girlfriend Julie, but she needs more time because the movie just started. And because the guy from Flight of the Conchords is hanging around her. And so she's mad at Paul Rudd for agreeing to going to a dinner for schmucks, even though the schmuck keeps ruining their relationship. So Steve Carell invites a stalker over because her ass looks similar to Julie's in a screenshot that he printed. But she throws bottles at him and leaves, so he invites her to Paul Rudd's business brunch the next day to make up for it. And he and Paul Rudd go to his IRS office, which is open in the middle of the night, and Galifianakis hypnotizes him and bangs his fat pudding wife. So then Paul Rudd likes Steve Carell for that, for a half second. But then Paul Rudd proposes to Darla, so the Swiss guy will think he's awesome, but she destroys his car. So they go to a ranch, and then Julie gets mad at him again, and Paul Rudd confesses that Steve Carell's an idiot, but feels bad, but then goes to the dinner anyway, where there's puppets and fire and fingers. But Paul Rudd confesses again, so they're friends again. So they go back to his apartment, and Paul Rudd says his favorite part of Julie is when he's unconscious beside her. So she takes him back. They bang in Paris while Steve Carell hides under the bed and masturbates, giggling like I do during podcasts. Spoiler alert. The end. Wow. You guys really like that one.
Yeah. It's so much funnier than the movie. That's why I loved it.
Really? Wow.
That almost made me enjoy the memories of the movie. That almost made me recall the movie fondly. Almost.
It makes it sound good, huh?
It really does. You've done it an injustice, Kelly Wand.
Yeah. See, in the pitch meeting, I don't know. It's Dinner for Schmaltz, this movie, I thought.
Well, now, did you guys know this is from a French comedy that was pretty well received, I believe.
It's La Dinée con some.
And it's a guy who's done a lot of French farces, like La Cage aux Folles and the guy with one red shoe, whatever the heck that is. But it's this guy that does French farces that get translated to American farces, and I don't... Mm.
And ruined in there in the translation.
Well, certainly in this case, I would say.
I heard in the French one, it's just him, it's just the two dudes and the wife, and those are the only characters. And that's one reason I think this movie sucks, is there's way too many distractions and wacky supporting characters talking to other wacky supporting characters who don't have any contrast. Mm-hmm. And I don't like redemption in my comedies. I don't like lessons. Give me Spinal Tap, give me Clouseau, give me Fish Called Wanda, give me Dumb and Dumber. Give me the first half of Bad Santa. I don't like people learning shit.
It gets awfully sincere before it's over, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't believe in any of these characters except for Paul Rudd, who I thought was good in it. But he's not in it. It's towards the end. It's just him rolling his eyes and watching shit.
Yeah.
It's too red light.
Now, Dingus, before we recorded, I overheard you saying this is the funniest thing you've seen in 3 years. Is that correct?
Yeah. I've only been watching Avatar for the last 3 years.
Thing is, why would you say this movie did or didn't work?
I've got two words. The first word was Steve.
Yeah.
What's the second word, though? Wait a minute. Wait for it.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it could
be Austin.
Could be Galifianakis.
Steve Galifianakis.
Yeah.
Carell is the second word.
Ah. So that's why this movie didn't work. What was your problem with Steve Carell?
I felt like every time the movie wanted to sort of start to pick up speed, it felt like somebody was throwing a wrench into the gears whenever he would enter a scene. And I'm a fan of his. I like mm-hmm. some of the stuff he's done, but I didn't get a thing he was doing. If you want to call what he's doing a characterization, I can't. I don't get anything he's doing with Barry. I think it's ridiculous. It's like sort of this just, I'm just going to throw out whatever I feel like throwing out, sort of in Robin Williams kind of style. And up until the moment he enters the film, I was really kind of grooving along. I mean, it sort of apes the last thing that I really liked Paul Rudd in, which I would like to talk about in a bit. But I liked Paul Rudd. I liked the things he was doing. I got him. I loved Jemaine Clement when he showed up. And then Steve Carell comes in, and you're just like, this isn't the character. What are you doing? And every time he entered, unless he was side by side with Jemaine Clement, really, who was the only thing that could temper him, I just never got what the heck he was doing, and he just was constantly tanking this movie. And it really, really surprised me and pissed me off.
I would say that Steve Carell's performance was more of a haircut than a performance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was all in, and I don't know if he had fake teeth or something.
He did. He had to have some sort of teeth.
Yeah.
He was really showing them off. That's what their whole movie was doing. It's like, well, look at this. Look how great this is.
And I couldn't help watching it, but thinking of The Cable Guy and thinking how a movie like this really needs someone who is as completely unhinged as Jim Carrey can be. And Steve Carell definitely was not that. Even though you could see him sort of maybe trying to push it in that direction from time to time, but he wasn't funny enough. He wasn't creepy mm-hmm. enough. He wasn't convincing enough. And I just feel that the movie, and it's partly Steve Carell's fault, I agree with you there, Dingus, but I think a lot of it's in the writing as well, it just keeps pulling its punches.
Yeah.
And
it's predictable.
It's predictable, and it's trying to be sincere and heartfelt.
Yeah.
And it every now and then pretends towards being a little creepy or weird or inappropriate, and it never quite pushes it far enough. For instance, a couple of things I'm thinking of. When he's giving him the front back rub, you know, he's hurt his back, he's on the couch, and Steve Carell straddles him, like that's this weirdly sexual thing. And there'd been another moment where they're really close face to face, like inappropriately close. And they never really played with that. It just sort of like happened twice, and nothing came of it. Another moment. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, another thing that came to mind was this idea that he's like creepy and untalented with these dead mice, when in mm-hmm. fact those things were pretty fantastic. Mm-hmm. They were really charming, and it wasn't the sort of thing that I would imagine a loser would do. I mean, in fact, I was watching it thinking, wow, that guy should be working for Henry Selick. You know, that stuff mm-hmm. looks fantastic.
And they're presented as charming and awesome.
Exactly.
Like, that's the payoff to it. Like, yeah, man.
And if they'd really wanted to push it, and these are supposed to be dead mice when they're obviously little stuffed animals, which are really cute, if they'd really wanted to push it, have him working with dead mice in these not very impressive dioramas where the joke is in him explaining what it's supposed to be. You know, if they'd, mm-hmm. they'd had the courage to really make it look creepy and like there were really dead mice in there, it would have been uncomfortable, and that would have been an interesting character choice. Instead, he's a really talented guy who makes these lovely dioramas.
Which isn't funny.
Not funny at all. Not funny
no.
at all. Charming and
there's a lot that's not
sincere.
Funny.
It's sincere instead of funny, yeah. And it thinks it's funny, I guess.
Paul Rudd's funny. He has some good... I liked his character, and I always liked Paul Rudd. But I kind of wish they'd switched roles. I almost like would rather have seen Steve Carell in the suit and Paul Rudd being...
Well, I... Wacky. As the as the resident non-Steve Carell fan, I just never find him funny. But I really liked his sincere performance in Little Miss Sunshine, which otherwise I didn't care for. But watching Little Miss Sunshine, I was like, that is, you know, give him real material. And they touch on that a little bit in Dan in Real Life. But yeah. I don't find him funny at all, but I find him very watchable. And I really want to watch him do serious stuff. So, Kelly, I would have loved that, to have seen them switching roles. That's brilliant. You're hired.
Yeah, see? Ready?
Yeah, I really like that, too, because I was racking my brain thinking, well, who do I put in here instead that really is going to get? Because this character, I don't understand what they're going for. Either he's this mousy guy. Sorry, I didn't.
Get it?
I didn't mean it that way. He's this easily controlled guy who is cowed and who has this little hobby where he's making dioramas that are basically a mirror of what's happened to him, how he got cuckolded by this jerk. Or he's this sort of free, wandering around like a penguin idiot. I don't understand the characterization at all. And I couldn't think, who do you put in that part? But I love that idea of swapping them.
Yeah, although Paul Rudd's just got more range, I think.
Well, I'm not sure what Paul Rudd would do. Like, can you think of something Paul Rudd has done in the past that would work in that? I mean, he would have to do...
Wet Hot American Summer, he was, like, kind of... I don't know. He was memorably... I mean, but he would have gone darker, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And the movie seems to be a few times tempted towards that darkness. Like, I love the fact that someone loses a finger at the end, but by that point, it's all...
Nothing happens.
I know,
because
right,
of it.
Right, exactly.
He even gets the deal still. He right. doesn't even... There's, like... And they make a monument. He makes a monument to his own missing finger... With the guy who caused that?
It was his wife's favorite finger. Get it?
Well, you know, which, by the way, I'm just going to jump right to that since you brought it up, Kelly Wand. I loved those dioramas, and I loved those epilogue pictures. But everything that is wrong with this film, for me, is encapsulated in the fact that they have this awful voiceover at the end. Steve Carell explaining all of these pictures to us. When, really... All we need is those pictures. All we need is to see those pictures, and it would have redeemed at least a little bit with me just to see those pictures and let me get the joke of what's going on in those pictures. I would have gotten those jokes. I don't need to have him explaining those jokes to me. And I felt like this movie was constantly making those kinds of mistakes. Constantly, I used the word predictable, Tom. It was constantly setting up these predictable moments. Oh, Julie shows up at the luncheon. What a surprise. Those types of, I'm overhearing the conversation, Three's Company kinds of moments as plot points that were driving me crazy. Just have a little respect for me, because the opening credits are gorgeous. And mm-hmm. and I got so hopeful. You know, you have that Fool on the Hill song and these lovely little moments, and then you have a reveal that these are his relationship moments. I mean, that's nice stuff, and they just scuttled it.
You have to wonder, though, who is the movie made for? I mean, that's what I kept thinking as I was sitting there, not enjoying myself, not laughing at anything, thinking, no, I'm not the audience for this sort of dopey comedy. And I'm assuming it's made for the kind of people, Dingus, who need that voiceover at the end.
Well, you're exactly really? Right. It's made for people who, when he's doing his Tower of Dreams presentation and he says, 500 years later, it's made for people who 3 or 4 seconds later go, 500 years later, did you hear that? It's made for those
yeah.
people.
Whenever I see a romantic comedy, I'm always thinking, why don't you two stop being retards and just fuck/get married already? Like from the
well,
first
it is
scene.
Such... That's
so annoying.
Yeah, well, a lot of what bothered me, sorry to cut you off, Kelly Wand.
I was done.
Well, I mean, because I want to agree with you there. But and a lot of what bothered me is that it is such a fake dilemma. You know, does he go to dinner to make fun of someone, or does he lose the hot French model that he's dating? I mean,
right.
That's so contrived. And the moment
she leave him over that,
right? Exactly, like, she leave him over that. She's not as into him. I mean, whatever their backstory is, that's not developed. It just needs to present this contrived false dilemma so that we can have this dramatic tension or what.
Yeah.
I mean, all of that, none of that sold me. I mean, you guys say you liked Paul Rudd in this, and I like Paul Rudd. He's really funny, and I like watching him act. But nothing in here, I didn't get the sense that there was any sort of a real person or a real dilemma in here. It all just felt so fake and forced to me, to where I didn't care about Paul Rudd's character.
But he didn't seem to care either. Like, he doesn't even seem to get it as annoyed as he should be in the movie. Like, he doesn't give a shit, which I kind of thought, he's not acting. He's really thinking of this. Yeah, I'm a rapper. Yeah, this is great.
Well, there's nothing of substance in his feelings in this. I mean, it's as lasting as the pain in his back. It's, you know, as soon as we're done with the shtick, we're just going to let it go. It's never going to come back. We don't care. I mean, his feelings in this are just about have as much basis as the pain in his back. As soon as that gag is over, it's over.
Right.
No matter what Darla does.
1-1-1-1-1 was. Oh, Darla was ghastly.
So I made a list of scenes that I want to know what people find these scenes funny, because there were things in this movie that I thought were so embarrassingly bad that I was wondering, does anybody on planet Earth think these are funny? And if so, is that person, who could possibly think, for instance, the spanking scene with Darla was funny? Who could possibly think that the woman communing with the lobster, that was just embarrassing.
Oh my God, the whole dinner scene was stunningly unfunny.
Yeah.
It was just aggressively unfunny.
Although I will say, Dingus, that I thought the dinner gunfight was better staged action scene than the snow fortress in Inception.
Agreed.
Zing.
But no,
more dreamlike.
That dinner gunfight, oh my God, that was horrible. There's a part.
The whole dinner was such a wretched payoff, and the movie's about the dinner, and it's in the title, and you go, "Oh, the dinner will be good."
And it takes so long to get there, too. You keep
that night goes on forever.
Yeah,
with contrived delay after delay.
Well, if you're going to get to a dinner that is that unfunny, and the choices that you make of the idiots are that poor, then be smart and don't even get to the dinner. You know, allude to it or just never get there and do something funnier. Because if that's all you're going to do as a payoff, forget it.
Yeah.
But see, Dingus, the blind guy doesn't know if he's a good painter or not. Do you get it?
What?
Thanks, James Cameron.
I can't see you.
This is lame because we all agree.
Well, okay, here we go.
Well, how can you not? I mean, there's just nothing.
We need to start an argument.
Well, I got to say,
I was hoping one of you would like it.
Well, Dingus and I were kind of foreseeing this because we're Paul Rudd fans, and we thought you can't possibly go wrong. So the whole time I'm sitting there watching it, I'm thinking, I feel so bad for having made Kelly go see this.
You learn a lot from comedies, though.
All right.
Like bad comedies. I see where this would have been good. I can see how I would have fixed it if I'd been hired. These cheap bastards didn't hire me.
Part of it makes me want to see the original French movie.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
I bet it's a lot meaner. I bet Paul Rudd's character is a lot meaner. Because his whole thing to Julie about there's a person you don't know and a person you do know. I'm going to guess, and I don't know, but I'm going to guess that Darla isn't somebody he had sex with 3 years ago in the French movie.
It's his mistress, actually, yep.
Oh, really?
I looked up on Wikipedia. It's a bona fide mistress situation, yep.
Okay, well that would make sense. And I'm going to guess he's an actual schmuck and not just somebody playing a schmuck at work.
See, they totally gelded the original story, as always.
You have to do that for
a man. Why? But it's not as funny. I don't understand why things got to be that way. It didn't used to be like this.
Well, I don't know about that.
Dude, comedies used to be crazy, and, I mean, Animal House? No one learns a lesson in Animal House.
You mean like Three's Company and Happy Days?
They all get expelled in Animal House. Yeah, those movies that you're talking about. What do you guys think of Jermaine, by the way?
So, Dingus, you said Jermaine. Something. Yeah, explain that, Dingus, because I'm pretty sure I disagree with you violently.
Really?
I've
already explained that, so you go ahead and.
Well, I had that on my list of who thinks this stuff is funny and not embarrassing. I didn't want to say anything because you said you liked him, but I'm afraid that I don't think Jemaine Clement is. I've never liked him in anything outside of Flight of the Conchords. I think he's brilliant in that, and I love that, and not even for the music necessarily, just his performance with Brett, whose last name I can't remember. Mm-hmm. I love those guys.
Kenzie.
Right, exactly. God, I forget that. I love those guys, but everything I've seen Jemaine Clement in outside of that, it's just, to me, seemed like it's fallen on its face. I just...
Like, what else has he been in? I don't know.
He was in a movie.
Eagle and the Shark.
Eagle versus Shark, where he plays... He's really mean to the female lead character, who's really meek and likable. And so maybe that's part of the problem. But just him playing this glamorous, pretentious artist just didn't work for me at all. And I didn't care for any of his... The gag about pulling the live zebra out of the uterus, and he's got a weird, there's this weird, I think it's supposed to be heartfelt scene where he confesses, I'm just a goat who's halfway through eating itself. And they're playing like serious music in the background.
Yeah.
They don't think that's funny. It's not funny, but not because it's, I mean, not because it's trying to be funny and it's not, but it's trying to be serious and it's stupid. It's not funny. And I just—he didn't work for me at all. I just didn't like him. I didn't like the jokes about him. And maybe I just see him as Jemaine from Flight of the Conchords too much. So,
well, it had potential.
I found him to be such a relief, and I loved this little exchange in the scene you're talking about, precisely because he's being serious and he's never winking at the camera, and he's never his energy is focused, and he calms down Steve Carell when he's in scenes with him. I thought he was so committed and so focused, and in this.
Yep.
This weird, and what I liked was the contrast to Flight of the Conchords, because he is so sexy here and not there.
Wow.
He's just weirdly sexy. And
okay,
he has this great exchange with Steve Carell, where he says, have you ever just spent 5 months living with goats as one of them? No. And his response is, really? That surprises me. I couldn't stop laughing at little moments like that. He takes himself and his weird sexuality so seriously. I mean, the photographs of him were idiotic, of course, but I just loved him. I thought he was great, and for me, it was just such a relief whenever he would enter the scene.
Well, I will grant you these. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, his very first scene with Paul Rudd, where he's insisting that he's a stockbroker. So that's like a stockbroker. No, not at all. Well, it'll help me if I call you a stockbroker. I just love that stuff.
So you,
he's
you,
the only one who didn't break character, Tom, you have to admit.
Well, I will grant you definitely, yeah, he was committed. I will definitely grant you that. And I did like those two lines, but I defy you to come up with a third funny thing that Jemaine Clement said. Go.
What?
Yeah, you pulled out the only two funny things he said. If you can give me a third funny thing that he said, I will concede your point.
I have to come up. I came up with two great things. I have to come up with
not great.
Funny
I would
thing.
Say they were great. They were good. If you can come up with a third funny thing, I will declare you the winner.
Mm.
You can think about it. And let me. You mentioned enjoying that part. While you're thinking about this, Dingus, I will confess to the one part that I found uproariously funny, and I lost my breath. And I'm not even sure I know why it was so funny. I can't really explain it. But the dinner with Darla, where she writes, I'm wet on a napkin, and
yeah, that was
passed
good.
Around to the Swiss guy, I loved that. And I briefly thought, okay, if the movie keeps doing this stuff, I'm on board. But then it just continually disappointed me. But for whatever reason, that Swiss guy being handed a napkin by Steve Carell that reads, I'm wet, in big red letters, I loved that. That was fantastic.
It's like that old jury joke that's from... Remember where the sleeping guy in the jury gets the note from the woman beside him, but she's just like reading what the rape victim wrote because she was too embarrassed to write it.
Wait! I like.
I'm describing jokes from the late law on a podcast on the internet. Please listen to it.
All right, Kelly Wan. While Dingus tries to think of a third funny thing that Jemaine Clement might have said, what? What's a moment that you found funny? What's a guilty pleasure you had in this movie?
The trailer for the Facebook movie before the movie.
Oh, well, I didn't watch that.
Ah.
Although
it does count because I went to see this at the ArcLight with my brother, who's in town here, and I was just bragging about how great the ArcLight was, and he was pretty wowed by it. He's from
a little place in Virginia called Gloucester. And they
don't have
theaters like this there. I went to see, I think, Robin Hood there, and we couldn't get into the theater because somebody had broken a bottle of vodka before we went in. But I was bragging about ArcLight not showing commercials. And the first thing that happens after the lights go down is this, it looks like an ad. It looks like a commercial, and it's that Facebook thing for the social network. It sort of looks like an ad. And then it was, you know, 20 or 30 seconds before I realized, oh, this is for the social network. Because there's this other trailer where a couple of guys are talking about creating the internet.
It's Middlemen. Yeah.
Oh, well, I didn't even know what that was. I assumed that was Social Network, and I just keep closing my eyes during that because I don't watch trailers. So this Facebook thing was kind of clever the way it starts. Sorry, Kelly Wand, I didn't mean to step on you, but
no, I like a horror movie trailer the way it starts, like, oh, Facebook's gonna possess you, and then you find out it's about illegal. Okay, what?
I guess this means, Dingus, you can't think of a third funny thing that Jermaine Clement said.
Oh, I certainly can.
Comedy when he was doing a funny walk with his back broken.
Oh, my God, that was terrible. I'm like, no, Paul Rudd, you're the straight man. Don't do funny back walking. I thought that was...
No, he couldn't help it because his back hurt, so he had to do a funny walk.
That was terrible. I did not... No.
Oh, Tom.
Give Paul Rudd a break. I have thought of a third thing that Jermaine Clement did that was funny.
He had to carry a lot of water.
Yeah.
All right.
Let's hear it.
When he's telling Tim, Paul Rudd, not to mate a mammal with a bird.
Yeah, sorry. That's not a funny thing.
You're wrong.
No, I can verify. I can scientifically prove that's not a funny thing.
She's a lion. He's a penguin. You can't mate a lion and a penguin.
See, you had two funny things, and you come up... That's on the list of embarrassing bits that I want to know who found that funny. And now
Tom
you're
hates animal
your
humor.
Name,
spoiler alert.
Your name by this. Dingus.
Liked the
JC. Okay, good.
I normally liked zoo animal humor,
but I also liked the. Have you ever had your arm up to the elbow in a zebra's uterus? And then the callback with Paul Rudd making fun of him and saying, "Have you ever had your whole head up its anus?"
Wow. I'm putting you in this category, Dingus. This movie was made for you.
Yep, that's right. It's me.
Dingus is a better putter than Jermaine. Spoiler alert. But there was also a zebra rug on his apartment floor, so that was a good...
And Zach Galifianakis had a zebra lining inside of his cloak. Let's talk about Zach Galifianakis.
Yeah, let's get to Zach Galifianakis.
Because I love me some Zach Galifianakis, and I don't know what happened in this movie.
Me too, and that's one of the things I wrote, is that, wow, if you can ruin Zach Galifianakis, wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
And he's ruined from the outset, because he takes off his coat and he's got that dickie on. And that's the same joke as Steve Carell's clip-on tie, which you've already done that joke. Okay, you can't, you know, it's not funny.
I didn't even think of it that way. Very good, Dinkus. Yep, yep. So nobody's going to go to bat for Zach Galifianakis in Dinner for Schmucks. All right. Kelly?
Well, you loved his gunfight.
So there's a part during the gunfight where he puts his arm around Bruce Greenwood and puts the gun to, you know, the fake little gun to Bruce Greenwood's head. And Bruce Greenwood is laughing and pretending he's having fun. And I'm like, wow, not even Bruce Greenwood is good enough to sell this scene because it looks so forced. Like, oh, no, nobody would laugh. But that's just weird and stupid and unfunny. And, yeah, nice try, Bruce. You're good. You're not that good. all right, well...
Well, Paul Rudd almost sells it. There's a little moment where Steve Carell like catches a bullet or deflects it, and he says thank you. And there's a little moment there that could have worked, but they never really commit to that scene or anything else. It's just so.
It reminds me of, and I've told you about this, Dingus. Kelly Wand, you have not seen Date Night, but you should. You should watch Date Night. Date Night is another tremendously unfunny Steve Carell comedy. And it's sort of like the movie goes on for, you know, this movie felt really long, by the way. This is one of those comedies that I think should have lost a good 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
And Date Night, that applies as well to Date Night. So Date Night goes along for a while. It's not funny. It has something, though, that Dinner for Schmucks doesn't have, and that is a real connection between the two main characters, Steve Carell and Tina Fey. Can sell this idea that they're a married couple and they're sort of entering the doldrums of their marriage, but they still love each other. And so they sell that relationship and that works. And there are a couple of serious moments that they don't earn, but they're effective nonetheless because they're both good enough at that role. But anyway, so date night goes on for a while. It's not funny. It's not funny. It's not funny. And finally, it's like this desperate ploy to just go over the top and try to be funny. Steve Carell and Tina Fey do this pretend strip dance thing, like a pole dance, trying to be really sexy to get invited over to the main mobster's table so they can talk to him. And it's just so sad and desperate. And that gunfight reminded me of this. It's sort of like you get to this point where your movie's not funny, so you just ingratiate yourself. You throw out all your dignity, and you get to seem like the gunfight or the pole dance in Date Night. And it's just because these actors can handle material. It's just, you know, give them material. Give Zach Galifianakis material. And he can do great things.
This is probably obvious. It's going to definitely be obvious to you, Tom, since this movie was on your list, and I alluded to it earlier. But it's such a great palate cleanser to watch I Love You, Man, after having watched this. Because my brother and I went to see this, as I said, and he's a good 20 years younger than I am. And he had never seen I Love You, Man, and I wanted to watch it again before doing the podcast. And so we watched it last night, and it was such a good experience. I had such a great bonding experience watching I Love You, Man with my brother. And I had liked I Love You, Man quite a bit, and now I flat out love it after having seen Dinner with Schmucks, because Dinner with Schmucks clearly is trying to do some of the things I Love You, Man does with the Lou Ferrigno thing and the Swiss guy. And there's a couple other things, but I Love You, Man just understands its relationship. It understands its characters, and it is just quick and smart. And I really, really love that movie. And so if you need to have your palate cleansed after seeing Dinner with Schmucks, I heartily recommend you watching I Love You, Man.
And can you guys go with me for bringing up Cable Guy? It's a pair of, like, I Love You, Man is a more sincere take on this. Cable Guy is, I think, a more dark take on this. Are you guys Cable Guy apologists like me?
I haven't seen Cable Guy in a really long time. Right. I remember liking it. I just don't remember how much. So I don't know. Is Kelly still here?
I guess Kelly bailed on us. Kelly Wand, come back. Yeah. We lost Kelly Wand.
Oh, crap. That's not going to go over well.
Yeah, he shows us online. All right, Kelly Wand. We can talk about him.
Yeah, I'm a Cable Guy apologist, and we didn't just stop for a long time.
Remind me to invite you on my next prison break, Kelly Wand.
Prism? Or prison? JK.
But Cable Guy is
a good, recording now. Yeah.
Cable Guy's a good palate cleanser for this, because I think it's an example of what this movie could have been like if it had committed more to the darker elements, whereas Dingus, your I Love You, Man comparison is what it could have been like if the more sincere elements had been effective.
Right.
I'm also a role models apologist, speaking of Paul Rudd apologists. But all these R-rated Paul Rudds are better than the PG-13 Paul Rudd. You heard me.
Is Cable Guy R-rated?
No.
It should.
He's not Paul Rudd either, so
good point.
Only R-rated, because Rudd, R.
Very good point.
See what I'm saying?
All right.
Avatar.
How do you guys feel about the other member of Flight of the Conchords cast who was in this film?
I really want to see somebody do something effective with her. I loved
She disappeared.
She disappeared. She was. It was such a thankless part. I mean, I was more enamored with what she got to do in Toy Story. Somebody please give her good material. She's so funny. I love her.
She didn't get to do anything.
I know.
And I didn't believe in her character either. She made the speech. Like, why would she say that? I didn't understand it. The same with Carell. It's like, I don't believe any of these characters exist. And then the comedy is immediately ruined. Because in Cable Guy, you kind of buy into it.
Yeah. I like her so much. I think that I would have liked Darla better if it had been her.
Oh, Dingus. You know, so right. So right, Dingus. Yes.
Because I like the way she looks. And they even made her, I don't know if it's the shooting or what, but she didn't even look as good as she normally looks. I'm not saying she's this penthouse beauty, but I like her. And she just mm-hmm. was just uninteresting and flat. And
well,
she's so
I would call her penthouse
she's so
beauty.
Intrinsically interesting.
Yeah. And one of my first inclinations that, oh, God, this movie's going to be bad, is when they give her jokes about not being able to get laid because she smells like cabbage.
Right.
Mm. I say, like, ooh, this is the level of humor. Oh, God. Oh,
yeah, cabbage. God. What is that? I didn't realize this was Dickens.
And meanwhile, we're going to recycle that joke later with formaldehyde.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. But that's the heartfelt instance of the joke, Dingus.
That's where you're supposed to cry.
Exactly. That's where we're humanizing the character. You see?
Why do they got to do that? I'm telling you, that's a new convention. This is 21st century filmmaking. Humanizing
your character. What a surprise that Barry winds up in bed with Tim. I couldn't believe that happened.
I can think of a better example of two men in bed together, two dudes in bed together. You guys know what I'm thinking of? Super Bad.
Mm.
Seriously, it's another bromance. Far better, I think.
When I was thinking of I Love You, Man, I was thinking of bromance, but this doesn't really qualify as a bromance. This is more like a reclamation project or something.
Recycled waste. It's environmental management.
Yeah.
It's a pretty standard formula. You know, the straight guy and his loser buddy. I think it reminds.
But it's one of the worst examples of it I can think of.
Yeah, yeah,
Planes, Trains, Automobiles was on a couple weeks ago and is way better than this.
Yeah.
And
ooh.
Steve Martin's way funnier than in this. I don't know, because it's about just the two of them, which is where the comedy's supposed to be. I mean, why do you got to have
two? Is
Swiss guy and.
Yeah, and I never understood. Like, I never bought that he wouldn't just say to this guy, "Look, get lost. You know, I don't need your apartment." None of that was convincing.
This is more trouble than it's worth. Fuck this.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll find an idiot who doesn't destroy my life. Like, and it keeps going for the whole night, and then the guy comes up with all these half-baked plans, and he just goes along with it and gets audited. It's just.
Or that the girlfriend wouldn't say, "Take him to dinner and get him out of here."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Girlfriends love it. They love idiot friends staying over for the night. Oh, they love it.
You're bringing up Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is great because Steve Martin gets to be truly mean in that Chatty Cathy speech. I mean, he is just acerbic. And here we have a couple of overheard lines, and that's it.
No, but see, mice don't lie, Dingus. That's something else dead mice don't do.
Was that supposed to be funny?
That was the heartfelt part. That was the serious humanizing.
Because the heartfelt music was playing, so I knew I wasn't supposed to be laughing. Thanks, James Cameron, for that comedy and music cue. I hate this movie. I hate you for making me see it.
Dingus, I hate you for making me see it, too.
I hate myself for making me see it.
But Paul Rudd describes him as, at one point, as a, quote, tornado of destruction. Which I felt at that point like he had been inside of a different movie than the one I had been watching. Because if more stuff...
And a sweet guy, too, he also describes him as.
Which he was a sweet guy, but he wasn't a tornado of destruction. You know, when the party, you know, the guy loses a finger, a bird flies away, and it catches on fire. Like, that was the close. And he didn't even do much of that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, when Darla comes over and trashes the apartment, he didn't do that stuff. He was not a tornado of destruction. And I feel there could have been, you know, more of a Planes, Trains, and Automobiles thing where the guy keeps making terrible things happen. But he's not, really.
I didn't get that, like, he's coming on, like, he goes on another guy's account and, like, hits on a chick, and then that, it, like, this is the guy we're supposed to, like, this is the sweet guy who lost his wife to this colleague.
He's not hitting on her, though. He's making what are supposed to be innocent replies, but there's a single entendre there.
But he likes her ass.
No, it's another weird thing. He's pretty asexual. Like, when she's saying stuff about you could lick cheese off my body, and he's like, well, I'm pretty sure my friend has some plates. You know, there's this idea that he's not at all, and she's like, oh, I've been naughty, I need to be spanked. He's like, well, that's not what we do in the IRS. I think the whole joke, and not being able to find his wife's clitoris, I think the whole joke is that he's completely asexual.
But then he finds he hooks up with Darla at the end?
He does.
Oh, my. In those mice dioramas,
right.
They wind up together, he and Darla, because they're obviously so compatible based on what we've seen.
And his line is, you know, she gave me a lot of clues, and I found it.
I thought that was his own wife. That was Darla. Okay, I got confused. Okay, he didn't get back with his wife. Yeah. How about that? Yeah, that was really funny. In case you needed the joke explained.
Oh, clitoris! Thanks, James Cameron.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between, counting 1, 2, 3, Peter Pan, Mary Free, getting
history. I'm done with this movie. You guys
yeah,
movie?
I can't.
Thank you, Brittany.
No one's going to listen to this.
No one's going to see
it. And we...
How much did the movie make?
We just talked...
We know?
Well, I got to tell you, us talking about it was great therapy for me. So, if it only exists for that, thank goodness.
All right, so on to a 3x3. Let's do this instead. So this week, I want from you guys three language shifts in movies. And I feel I really shouldn't have taken them off the table because I took a few movies off the table, which I shouldn't have taken off because it turns out I kind of needed them.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
Sure. I don't know what you guys thought of this, but I had a hard time with it. So I want instances of in a movie where the language changes or shifts. The things I took off the table were 13th Warrior, forgot what else, Inglourious
Bastards,
and then maybe Meet the Fockers or Meet the In-Laws, one of those things. So what does that leave us? Kelly Wan, since you were introducing this week's 3x3, you have to go first. What is your number three example of a language shift?
Crap.
Yeah, I like that one too. I thought that was a good one.
That was one of mine.
Yeah, oh, you scooped me, Kelly Wand.
All right, I'm going to do a different one. I know we're not supposed to, but I'm going to do a different one.
I'm going to change my list if that's the one Kelly Wand is picking. Gosh. All right.
Oh, here we are talking naturally. What are we talking about?
What's your number three? Your number three.
Oh. Wait, did it record when I said I finished this list before we'd finished recording last week's podcast?
Did you now? So you had a pretty easy time of it.
Yeah, it was super easy.
Are they all retarded. The same movie?
Yeah. They're not movies I've seen either, but I still think they're...
All right, well, what's the third one?
Okay, first off, is Navi a language?
We did
make that joke last week.
Yeah, that's right, you're now recycling the joke.
Yeah, but no one listens to it, so I'm just going to keep doing it until we get a hit. Okay, thank you. You're welcome, listeners. Okay, now my number three is the movie... I'll do a line from it.
Awesome.
Tonda Aluna Lana?
Oh, Dances with Wolves.
Lion King. Is it the Lion King?
I hate you people.
Is it Klingon? I can't tell if you're speaking Klingon.
Really?
Is that Klingon?
Well, I almost used
Klingon
this time. Yeah.
Tonda Aluna Lana. Lady Hawk?
Are you doing your list right now?
I don't know this line.
Zug Zug? It's the movie that gave us Zug Zug.
Would that be Return of the Jedi?
Oh.
Zug Zug is...
That was a runner-up, though. Return of the Jedi.
Zug Zug is from a video game, Kelly Wand.
No, they stole it.
Are you serious?
Yeah. From this
wow.
movie.
I have no... I don't know the movie.
The slogan for the movie was a pre-hysterical hit. Okay, here's another one.
Is Barbara Bach?
Yay! Yes. Dingus wins, though.
See, hey,
man. Come on, they invented a whole language for that movie, man. It's totally The Rich Man's Quest for Fire.
My all favorite Ringo Starr movie.
Yeah, it is. It is your favorite.
Good.
Kaka is another line from it. See?
Who directed and
shit? Man.
That seems like something that Richard Benjamin might have directed.
It was Joe Roach.
It was Carl Gottlieb who wrote Jaws. The writer of Jaws directed.
Oh, wow. How's
that Peter Benchley wrote Jaws.
No, you're thinking of Louisa May Alcott.
Oh,
all right, that's my three. Really enjoy you people.
All right,
Kate. That was also the movie that gave us Dennis Quaid and Shelley Long. In their,
And Zug Zug comes from Caveman. Wow. What does it mean, caveman? Is it just acknowledgement, or what?
It means fucking.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
No.
Just like it does in Warcraft.
I don't believe you. You've shaken my worldview to the foundations, Kelly Wand. Wow.
Angus will back me up, because he's a caveman apologist like me. Right. I'm very upset you don't like caveman, Tom.
I don't remember it.
You don't know what Zug Zug... Well, that's because you hate Blizzard.
I don't remember caveman that well. Does it have stop motion dinosaurs?
Caveman's also a really awesome RTS. Yeah, it does. It has claymation dinosaurs, and they eat like the weed berries that he uses to try to seduce Barbara Bach.
Wow. Part of me thinks I should see this again, but part of me is probably not going to.
No, that makes me think of Zabumafu.
of what film he is?
Not a film.
Richard Kiel. So,
oh, Ega is great.
Yeah, Ega is great. I agree with you.
Watch out for snacks.
Yeah, remember Tom?
No. I love Ega, yeah.
Tom, who's your favorite caveman in movies?
It would have to be Michael Cera from Year One.
Mine is Daryl Hannah.
Very good. I'm kind of preferential to Moon Unit Zappa.
Oh, yeah. Good choice.
All right,
I like the guy who discovers bones kill people in 2001. Okay, Dingus' turn. Like you.
All right, Dingus, what is your number three choice for a language shift?
Does that count as a language shift, Caveman?
Not really, but we'll give it to you.
The other two are better.
It doesn't have to be a shift. It's just use of language in a scene.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
It was best uses of another language.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Wait.
Well, that's not a shift. You totally changed the whole thing tonight.
Hold on a minute.
Go back and listen.
I have here language shifts that I wrote
down.
That's
not what you said on the podcast, which is
Well, you gave examples of language shifts, but what you actually said the category was best use of another language in a scene.
Well, what's the other language? Well, then you could just use a foreign film.
That's what Kelly did.
Well, yeah. I did. It's called Caveman. It's from Mexico. Right. You racist.
Well, I like this. We'll see how you do with the others. So
the other two are fit into your revisionist.
Let's see what Dingus did. Dingus, what's your number three?
My number three is Amelie.
Mm. Are you lying?
Yes, of course I am. All right. So guess what I'm going to do.
Dingus is putting again.
Dingus, give us a line.
He sliced it.
So if you
you whiffed.
Yeah.
Whiffed.
All Dingus right, just made
you're right. Since Tom is calling for a line, I'll give you one. You ready?
Yep.
Here we go. That's all he said?
Oh, what?
Ah, very good. Lost in translation.
Nice, Tom. Very good.
What's the language?
Japanese.
The language is Japanese.
Hey, Dingus, you explain the scene. I love that scene.
This is what immediately leapt to mind. A couple things immediately leapt to mind, but this is the only one that stayed on the list. And this is the photo shoot, or rather the commercial shoot, early in the film of Lost in Translation from 2003, directed by Sofia Coppola, where Bill Murray's Bob Harris is getting direction for his commercial for Suntory Whiskey. And the gag is the director comes up and just talks and talks and talks in Japanese, just giving him direction for how to do the scene. And he just goes on and on and on. And then the translator finally comes over to Bob Harris and says, he wants you to turn and look in the camera, okay? And that's all she says. He says, that's all he said? And then he asks, should I turn this way or that way? And then the director comes and just unloads for a long time. And she says, with intensity.
Yeah. More intensity.
Said, is that everything? It seemed like he said more than that, and I just love that. That gag is a great gag.
I think you're doing a great job, but you are not doing justice to Bill Murray's delivery. I mean, it's all in Bill Murray's delivery there. Yeah.
Will you do that for me?
I'm sorry, I'm not up to it. I've got my own lines to quote later on in the list. Sorry.
I guess it was lost in translation.
Oh.
This film does, I mean, it's called Lost in Translation, so it's kind of an obvious choice. But I watched it again this week, and there's a scene that I didn't remember. It's a little moment later in the film where Bill Murray is in a sauna, and there's these two German dudes talking. And there's no way for us to understand what they're saying. They're just talking in German, and he just sort of looks over at them and looks away. And it's just a great – there's a lot of little great language moments in this film. But that moment – is wonderful, and then the later photo shoot where they're asking him to be like James Bond, but the Roger Moore James Bond, which is really funny because of Suntory and Sean Connery doing Suntory ads. But I just love that early, and I always, as soon as Tom said this category, I just thought more intensity.
Very good, Dingus. All right, my number three is a bunt. I'm bunting.
You better not do what I think you're going to do.
Doing sports analogies? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. No, I don't know what you think I'm going to do, but this is not a substantial part of the movie, but it's a part of the movie that I love, and I'm not sure I understand. I want to talk about it a little bit. But there's a part in Die Hard where...
You jerk.
Where Alan Rickman tells... Who's the guy? Is it...
John McClane?
No. It's the big German fella who plays his henchman.
Hans Gruber.
No.
Alexander Gudinov.
Is that right, Dean?
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
The character.
I don't know what the actor's name is.
Yeah, he tells him to shoot the glass, but he says it in German. And,
all right.
And that's just something that I mean, I don't know about other people's circles of friends. I'm assuming everybody's circle of friends where one or more of the members has seen Die Hard periodically says to each other, "She's in der Fenster," or whatever. I mean, I don't even think I'm doing it right. But now let's talk about that moment. Why does Alan Rickman say this in German to the other dude? Anyone?
Because John McClane won't hear... Because he's German. That's what I thought it was.
Because he knows John McClane's not wearing shoes.
Right.
And he's trying to... he's trying to get the advantage in their favor.
So it's,
well, now, why is he saying in German, though?
But it is so that John McClane, like, he sees John McClane's barefoot, but it's so that Alexander Gudinoff will shoot the glass and then make John McClane cut his feet up. But why does he have to hide the fact? Why does he have to say it in German so that John McClane can't understand? That's what I don't understand. And why does Alexander Gudinoff not understand German?
He doesn't.
Well, he looks like he doesn't understand it, and Alan Rickman has to say, "Shoot the glass," which helps for those of us who don't understand German, what he had just said.
Well, maybe they're not all German. Maybe they're all European.
Which, by the way, "Schieß den Fenster" doesn't even mean that.
It means shoot the window.
Right.
Right.
They were windows, though.
No, they were like cubicles. That weren't they like cubicle glass or like window? Technically, maybe it's different in German, but it's technically something on the side of a building that looks outside. So I don't know. Maybe the guy is Russian instead of German. Maybe it is a translation problem. But that moment always puzzled me. I love that moment, but I'm just not really clear on it.
It's an iconic action moment because it's never been done before. Name another movie before that where they shot the glass so they could follow the hero's footprints.
And they're not faceless villains, so it therefore is iconic.
Yeah.
The moment, the language moment I love for that movie is Schnell. That's the one I use all the time.
When does someone... Well, Schnell, I mean, what? Schnell could be from Hogan's Heroes.
It is, that famous movie that we're talking
not
about.
Not the way that they're saying when they're chucking the handheld grenades or the RPGs over to the guy off of the elevator. Schnell! I mean...
That sounds like Hogan's Heroes to me, Dinkus, when you do it.
Like all German, that's to Tom, because he's a racist. He's a racist against the master race, the worst kind of racist. Go on.
Dinkus, did you really think I was going to pick Die Hard?
Yeah, and I was so close to picking it, and you using the word bunt is a perfect word for this.
Okay.
Because until I found my last one, Die Hard was my bunt, or my whatever you want to call it, my walk. I don't know.
Yeah,
that was my safety. I had two safeties. Die Hard was the most likely one because when I brought up this category, my wife, who knows German and who has to deal with me saying "Schieß den Fenster" and "Schnell" around her family. And I said, "Oh, well, of course you're going to use that."
Why are you telling your in-laws to shoot the glass?
Because sometimes they try to use German to hide things that they don't want me to hear.
Even though they're Italian?
Yeah, it's weird.
All right.
No access.
They do. They do. I mean, you know, I don't know if you've ever been around people who speak another language and they you know, it's your birthday and they're saying things to try to hide from you what's going on. And, like, you can't pick up context clues to figure out what they're saying is birthday cake. But they do that to me all the time.
People.
So I say Schnell when they say that.
What, Dinkus, is
what
German?
What do they say?
What's German for birthday cake?
Kochen.
That's hot.
Kelly Wan, what is your number two language shift? Or seen in another language or whatever the subject is, the topic is.
Wait, I should have done a quote because I just have it written down. Ain't nothing but a thing.
That's the name of the movie?
No, it's probably not even a quote.
Ain't nothing but a chicken wing on a string.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay, it's when Barbara Billingsley does jive in Airplane.
Ah, very good, very good.
Yeah, that's a good one. Nice.
Jive in Airplane is a good one.
I should find a quote, though.
Who is Barbara Billingsley?
She's the mom from Leave It to Beaver.
Yeah, she's the Beaver's mom.
Yeah.
She's in Airplane?
Cleaver.
That's June Cleaver?
Yeah. June Cleaver does jive and says, shit.
That's why it's funny. Yeah.
Comedy class. Yeah, right. See? They get comedy. Take that, whatever we saw tonight. Schmuck. Yeah, Dinner for Schmuck. I think
didn't
I'm calling it Dinner
Airplane
for Idiots.
This week?
Yeah. Who, me?
No, I thought Tom went to see Airplane this week.
He did?
Apparently not.
No. I haven't seen Airplane in, many years.
I like that choice, Kelly. That's a good one. And it didn't even occur to me in the slightest. That's nice.
Yeah, I guess it's racist because...
it's okay, Stuart. Is.
I speak to the bone. Yeah. Cuddy say he can't hang. Jive-ass dude don't got no brains anyhow.
Could you get away with that scene these days? Like, could you have that in a movie like Dinner for Schmucks?
No, and that's why comedies suck now. And Airplane will always tower over.
But nobody would get it. We're not close enough to...
Jive is a dead language.
Yeah.
But it's funny still when you see it, though. We get it. But I wonder if kids watching it go, what? Wait, why aren't they talking rap? Because that's what be the... when they remake Airplane next year. When
hey, is would Airplane be dated for like kids these days? I don't know.
It'd
well,
be
it
the
would
opposite.
Because well, it was riffing on those airport films. And they don't have those.
Right.
It was riffing on a movie no one even saw, like a specific movie called like...
God, I hate to think that the equivalent of Airplane movies these days are those like those riffs on like 300 and I Know What You Did Last Summer and I don't even
Scary
know what
movie.
You call those movies. Scary movies, stuff like that. Like that is
no,
those
that's the modern Descendants. Airplane? No, you're right.
Wow.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, that's all those parodies exist because of Airplane.
That's what the debased Descendants of Airplane.
Well, maybe they're good.
They're the cannibal inbred. Never mind. That's my number two.
All right. I think it's
love Barbara Billingsley in that. Okay. So good.
Well, what is your number two, Dingus? Favorite language shift.
All right, my number two, and it was really hard for me to order number two and one, but I'm going to give you guys a quote from number two. Then say it. Here we go. I'll try again. Then say it. You got something to say to me, then say it. I'd like to hear you speak instead of your little dog. Woof, 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 woof.
Is that Mel Gibson to his ex-wife?
Racist. That's Inglourious Basterds, isn't it? Wait. It's that movie where Reese Witherspoon is in Tennessee.
I don't think I know it. Have I seen it, Dingus?
Sweet Home.
I'm pretty sure you've seen it, Tom. Here's another quote from it. Okay. You can't speak, so why don't you flap your hands about and have what's-his-name tell me where you've been, or do you think I don't know?
It sounds like you're trying to do Daniel Day-Lewis from There Will Be Blood. Am I right?
I'm trying to do that. Very good, Tom.
What is the language shift?
Yeah.
The language shift is sign language.
Mmm. Clever girl.
Wow, Dingus, that's heavy.
It's a beautiful scene. And I had trouble deciding between two scenes in this movie, but I went with this one because I love the scene. I love the way it's shot. And I love the juxtaposition of the brutality of Daniel Plainville, Plainview's, what he's saying and how he's mocking his deaf son. And his deaf son is trying to express his love for his father and his becoming a man and his growing independence while trying to couch those things in terms of love. And all Plainview, all the father has, the father in air quotes, has for his son is mockery for both him and his interpreter. And the first quote I gave you, the, you know, your dog woof, 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 and is just this awful vitriol, and what I like about the juxtaposition is how beautiful it sounds to hear Daniel Day-Lewis say anything, and how intrinsically beautiful I think sign language is. Just watching it, no matter what is being said, and you can barely see it because of the way the scene is lit and the way the scene is shot, but you can see some of it. And coming after the scene that just came before, I just find this to be a beautiful. A beautiful sort of collision of languages.
Man, I can't wait to hear what you had to replace that
there
with
will be
your number one.
Yeah.
Good.
My Left Foot, he uses another language. Spoiler alert.
Damn. Is that your number one, Kelly?
No, I just ruined someone else's face. Sorry about that.
Yeah, that was going to be my number two. I'm going to change it now. All right, are you guys
would
ready?
Have reacted more strongly. If
That's true. Had. You're right. Okay, you ready for a line? So before we've given lines, I'm actually going to play a clip. You guys ready for this? Let's go to the clip.
I mean, this is going to be a good opportunity. If we play this right...
I don't know anything. He's a sketchy character. I don't want to talk about him in front of the...
Okay, let's drop it.
Okay?
Let's drop it. Let's X-nay on the Bex-nay. Big pay Adelaide.
Can you X-nay your Alf, man?
I ain't saying it.
I don't know. You're doing it wrong. I don't understand what the hell you're saying.
Anch pay ube.
Hey, X-nay your ass A.
A-way.
X-nay your ace fay. Asshole A.
So that's my number two. Is a pig,
Maid, yep, right?
It is a pig Latin from Maid, the scene in Color Me Mine.
Make sure we're still recording after you did that little technical weirdness.
Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant. I didn't even think of that.
Was that improv? Because it sounds so natural.
Well, they're just so, I mean, I think they're so good with each other. They're obviously buddies. I mean, that's so much of what makes Maid work. Is their relationship and how well they riff off of each other's different styles. And you can see in the outtakes, there are a lot of outtakes. The CD has a lot of great material on it. The DVD has a lot of great material on it, stuff they didn't use or extended scenes. And you can see how they're shooting some of the scenes. And they're just, yeah, it's got this improvisational feel to it. I mean, it's just Vince Vaughn sort of riffing on stuff and Jon Favreau being really exasperated with him. So I just love that.
Which is
Pig Latin scene.
And that's a good example of character-based comedy that works, which the movie we saw.
You know what? Yeah, exactly. The straight guy and his loser friend. Yep.
And everyone else in the movie's straight except for that one character, and that's the comedy.
Right.
Well, as and in it, Dinner yeah. for
and
Schmucks, everyone's...
And it's not afraid to go dark, dark,
yep.
dark.
No.
Yep.
A great movie.
All right, so the Pig Latin in Maid is my number two, and that's actually what made me think of the topic. I just wanted some excuse to bring that up. So there you go.
That is so pleasing. That is such a great play on this. Ah, damn. And I look through my, you know, one of the things I do is I look through my DVDs. I just look at each title and sort of think through the topic. And I can think of tonight looking at Maid and just moving past it. That's great.
Utshe, your ace fay. Asshole. Bunch pay ube. And I love, too, like, I have no idea what Vince Vaughn is trying to do. It's like that hubba wubba language from Zoom mixed with Pig Latin. But say he goes, unch pay ube. And what could unch pay ube possibly mean? And he does it like a threat. Like, he's pointing at him saying, unch pay ube. And I'm going to punch you? Where is the
punch ube?
Number?
Yeah.
Punch unch pay ube.
And Jon Favreau has that Buster Keaton look on his face for the whole movie, no matter what, how silly Vince Vaughn's being.
And it works so well, too.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, and Jon Favreau is so good in that.
Like in Iron Man. Yeah. He's almost as funny as he was in Iron Man.
You had to say that.
I saw, what was that Jon Favreau show where dinner, he was like talking to a bunch of different actors on
Dinner
IFC?
For Five.
Dinner for Five. Yeah. That's
was
a great
that
show.
There was one like post made where he was eating with Vince Vaughn and Peter Falk, and Peter Falk was telling Vince Vaughn, "Oh God, you were such a hog." Vince Vaughn's totally ripping on him.
Well, that's one of the outtakes on the DVD is poor Peter Falk.
But he's playing
so
off.
Exasperated that they can't get the scene because Vince Vaughn keeps screwing things up, and they're laughing and giggling. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine a lot of the exasperation to his character was genuine.
Yeah. But that helped the movie.
Yep, absolutely. It comes through. Yeah.
Remember that part where he opens the envelope and the money spreads?
So this is mine. And he's fixing it with tape, with scotch tape.
How do you do that? That is just brilliant. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
How is that not CG? How does a man do something that beautifully? Don't.
That is brilliant.
God, I love that. I love it when stuff just works perfect.
There's a dinner for five with... With Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner and Colin Firth and Kevin Smith, that is just fantastic. Because you can really see, and this is well before that, you can see that Jennifer Garner is freaking totally in love with Ben Affleck. And there's
I don't
just,
want to see that.
There's so many great dynamics going on at that table. I loved that show. That's a great show.
And yeah, what happened to it?
Iron Man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'll happen.
All right, Kelly Wan, what is your number one instance of a language shift? Or
it's my favorite Steven Soderbergh movie. Name it. Ocean's 12. JK.
Schizophrenia.
Really? Yay!
It's a language shift from Schizophrenia. Right?
That's
they
good.
Start talking, yeah, the gobbledygook.
That's really good, actually. Are they talking backwards, or what are they doing?
Yeah, I don't know how they did it.
Oh, no, it's a nameless numberhead man?
Sure.
Where the guy is just making up words, noseworthy.
Yeah, and the whole sequence is directed like that.
Nameless numberhead man. So, I mean, that's one of the things he said.
Is that his name?
One. No, it's not. But that's something he says about somebody else.
Tom, did you see that movie?
Either no, or it didn't register very well with me.
Really?
I'm going to say he did see it. He saw it because my friend Yuri and I made him watch it, and he just was completely underwhelmed.
Yeah. Really? You didn't like the there's like a Lost Highway kind of thing where he becomes the other dude.
I don't go much for the sort of absurdist movies. Not really my bag. I'm not
I do.
French.
What?
The French love that stuff.
All right, Ocean's 11.
That's right. Ocean's 12 is more my speed as far as Soderbergh movies. I love the joke. I don't know if you guys have seen it. There's a great meta joke about Julia Roberts playing herself. I love that kind of stuff.
That's not great.
No, it's...
No. No,
that's
it's
more
not.
My...
They don't name her. It's... Oh, she looks just like her. Isn't that what they say?
Yeah, no.
Something stupid like
that. I don't want anyone to believe that, by the way. I can't stand that.
You sounded pretty convincing.
I know.
How come your best acting's always on the podcast? Didn't come out.
So, no, yeah, I don't recall Schizopolis. So, describe the scene for us, Kelly Wand.
There's a character named Schwitters. Is that who I'm thinking of? No, wait. Dr. Korchak? Dingus, you remember. Was it L. Ron Hubbard? Who's the guy?
Well, I assume you're talking about the exterminator who speaks weird,
yeah.
But they also do this
Elbow
weird...
Oxygen.
Like... There you go. Yeah.
They do this weird what?
There is a specific scene where they do this weird, like, backward talking thing that happens.
I thought it was a whole sequence, but maybe I don't. I haven't seen it.
It might be, but I don't know if you're talking about a specific scene or if you're just talking about the character of the exterminator guy who just talks in non sequiturs.
It's not non sequiturs. It's a different language. He's speaking in a nonsensical code.
And yeah, I think you're right about that, yeah.
And what's the point of it in the movie? Like, what role does it play? Why is he doing that?
I kind of forget, but it's good.
Okay, all right.
Does that help at all? Yeah. This is a great podcast. he's taking pictures of his genitals.
Whoa, wow, man, you'd think I'd remember that.
Well, yeah. I think one of the things that's great about it is kind of a comment on Hollywood because these producers come to hire him to do this thing that he does, and then they want to sort of tame it. So he's got this weird thing that he does, this strange way of talking, and these producers are, we very much like this. But I think they want to make it marketable.
Can you give
it's
us
like
an example
white...
of it? Kelly Wand, can you do a line?
No, they didn't, it wasn't like that.
All right.
He was like the white Pootie Tang.
Did you bring us a clip?
I'll have one by the time the podcast is over. That helps at all.
All right, so Dingus, that's a tough one to follow.
Yeah, especially with my lack of specifics. That was really hard.
There's something else that happens where this is actually a really great choice, Kelly Wan, because there's a lot of things with language that go on in this. There's a weird thing I remember where, like, the wife and...
Generic
and
greeting.
That, yeah.
Generic greeting returned. Imminent sustenance. Okay. Overly dramatic statement regarding upcoming meal.
How did you just accessed that? That's awesome.
No,
that,
I
yeah,
just
you're right. That's good.
Yeah, Mr. Oh, I can't do a line. It's not like that. And you just did a whole scene, Kelly Wand.
Tom doesn't like absurdist movies. That's kind of
not really. I really don't. Most of that kind of stuff doesn't work for me.
But horror is not usually absurdist in your horror nerd.
What did you say the exterminator's name was, Kelly Wand?
Oxygen, Elmo Oxygen.
Yeah. Something he says nose army. And that's something, and it means something else, like thank you or something, I don't know.
Arsenal nose army. Beef diaper? Throbbing dust generation? It's like a naked lunch, Tom.
Oh.
That's why you don't get, because you're racist.
Exactly, yeah. I just feel there are so many. I mean, look, absurdist stuff has its place. I don't deny that, and I'm all for a little creative deconstruction. But I just feel like there are so many things that can be said without having to resort, without having to fall apart into absurdism. So there you go.
So absurdism is a crutch for you.
It just waters down the message. I mean, it obscures messages. Well, that's kind of the point of it in a way, and I'd rather just have my message straight up, no chaser.
I think execution's everything, and you got to take these things on a case by case.
You know, Kelly Wand, you mentioned horror. I hope I'm not scooping anyone on this pick, but there's an absurdist horror film. It's a little Canadian film. It's ostensibly a zombie movie, and it's called Pontypool, and it's based on a stage play, I believe, and it's about a viral outbreak. It takes place inside a radio station one night. A guy's showing up for like a late night shift doing a radio show. And there's an outbreak of some sort of like zombie virus that turns everybody murderous, and it's passed along through language. And it ends up being a horror movie slash sort of language deconstruction. It's not really technically an absurdist type story, but it reminded me of that. Did I scoop anybody? Is Pontypool, are you guys big Pontypool fans?
That was a huge one. Yeah, that was my number one, so you technically can't.
But Kelly Wand, Dingus, not so much you, because I think you've got too much good horror to catch up on. But Kelly Wand, I would recommend Pontypool to you.
All right, so I'll write it down and delete it. Pontypool. I like. What, Dingus?
Well, I was just going to say I have a real soft spot. I mean, I understand what you're saying, Tom, as far as your objection to Schizopolis is concerned, but I have a real soft spot in my heart for that film because I feel like I can't divorce it from what I think or what I imagine was going on with Soderbergh at the time. Was he was sort of fighting against a bad experience he was having dealing with being somebody who was going to become a big budget director and failing at that. And so he made this little throwaway movie and just got to be as free as he wanted to be and just do whatever he wanted to be. And so when I saw it, it was just such a breath of fresh air for me and also so exciting for me to see a director I really love being able to sort of regain his footing by doing something that nobody was going to see except for a few people and that would give him a creative outlet. So I have a real soft spot in my heart for Schizopolis.
Yeah, it's personal film, Tom. They don't make those anymore. So you should
I would say Bubble is pretty personal.
It is.
You're absolutely right. And
Bubble was something very similar to Schizopolis in that it's just a small. I mean, Dingus, you call it a throwaway, and that's like one way to put it. I see what you're getting at, but I imagine it's in a way just the opposite, where he feels very close to the material in a way that he might not to something like Ocean's 12, which is just sort of a goof. Like in a way, I think of Ocean's 12 is the throwaway, whereas like Bubble and Schizopolis, those are things he does out of passion.
The Two Towers of the Ocean trilogy.
But Bubble shows a lot more discipline, and I think that's what I was talking about with Throwaway, is that he can be wild. It's like a dance that has no choreography, whereas Bubble is it has more discipline.
Yeah. Well, it does on the part. Yeah, exactly. Like Bubble's fascinating for how it does have discipline as a story, like what he did as a director, but the way he uses non-actors and the way they're in it and the way that they're not professionals and the way the movie benefits from that. Like there's a lack of sort of process and professionalism in the best possible way in Bubble as well.
You're exactly right, and I think the difference is he casts himself as the lead in Schizopolis, and he's just goofing around in front of a mirror.
Both the leads.
And this is him sort of vomiting up, and Bubble is not that. You're absolutely right.
Kelly Wand, have you not seen Bubble?
Is it Soderbergh?
Yeah. I think it's one of the. Yeah, it's definitely. It's
all right,
very,
I'll check
very
it out. Is it early Soderbergh?
No, it's post Ocean's, right after Ocean's 12, maybe. Do I have that
and
right?
You do it as a palate cleanser for the Ocean's
definitely.
Movies,
it's the serious man to burn after reading for.
Really?
Yeah.
That's great. Wow. Yeah, and it's so. I think it made my list that year. It's just you got to see it, Kelly. It's yeah.
All right, I'll check it out.
Put it above Pontypool.
Okay. I'm an experimental movie apologist, Tom.
These two are right up your alley, then. All right, Dingus, what is your number one use of shifting another language?
Or shifting a topic for 3x3 in week to
right, here's the quote. The avowed purpose of this tribunal is broader than the visiting of retribution on a few men. It is dedicated to the reconsecration of the Temple of Justice.
What? Is that from StarCraft?
Yeah. This is when the Zerg learned to speak Cardassian.
Wait, that's totally some kind of like... It's either a Star Trek movie or some courtroom drama.
It's got to be a courtroom.
It is a courtroom drama.
Is it a Star Trek
courtroom
drama? Paths
of Glory?
It is not Paths of Glory.
Break apart. Help angry men. The Client.
That's Tom's idea of a courtroom. John Grisham, instantly.
Are there clues? Oh, Munich.
It's not Munich, but you're in the right. You're in the right country.
Judgment at Nuremberg.
Yeah.
There you go, Kevin.
Really?
Yeah.
Ah, like you.
I haven't seen this movie. I don't watch documentaries. What's the language?
Well, they're speaking Japanese, which is weird. No, this is... I've been watching this film again, thinking it would be a chore, and it is freaking fantastic. All right, so Tom brought up... and I can't even remember, what's the Antonio Banderas thing you brought up that you took off the table?
13th Warrior.
13th Warrior, thank you. Tom, are you still there?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm just listening.
So,
yeah.
Respectful
so,
silence.
So there's this thing that's done, and this is one of my runners-up, and I won't bring it up because Kelly Wan hasn't done his number one yet, or Tom hasn't, or somebody. Tom has better. Where we do a language shift. This is a perfect language shift, and this is something that came to me pretty quickly. When you do sort of the we're gonna switch the language so that everybody in America can understand this film for the rest of the movie. This is sort of what you go to as the starting point, because what happens is Maximilian Schell, the above quote is spoken by Maximilian Schell playing a Hans Rolf, who is the it's in his opening statement for the defense of four judges. The judgment of Nuremberg is about these four judges who are being judged by an American tribunal for crimes against humanity, of course. We've already had the trials that got the big names out of the way, and now we're getting to the judges, the people who should have upheld the law, who should have known better and didn't. And that's what judgment in Nuremberg is about. It's about these judges who should have known better, and whether or not the laws of the land that they were interpreting, whether it was right for them to interpret the laws of the land or whether they should have stood up against those laws of the land. And you have this moment. It's this very beautifully clunky opening where people have headphones on their heads and there's interpreters behind these glass partitions. And so the idea is like this idea we get from watching things from the UN, where an attorney says something in another language and an interpreter behind glass is going to say it, and then somebody else is going to hear it over headphones and they're going to respond in their language, and then the interpreter is going to say something, and then it's going to go back and forth and back and forth. And so Stanley Kramer, who directed this film, has to find a way out of that so that we don't have to have a three-hour movie become a six-hour movie. And the way he does this is Maximilian Schell gets up to give his opening statement for the defense, and he says what I just said, the avowed purpose of this tribunal. And as he's speaking, he's saying this in German, and we're hearing it from behind the glass through the interpreter. And the camera slowly rises over the glass, and as he says the word tribunal, the camera zooms in to Maximilian Schell, and then he says, is broader than visiting the retribution on a few men, in English. And from then on, we understand that this is the shift. We've gone from hearing him say everything in German and hearing a translation to he's going to speak in German, and we're going to believe that he's actually speaking in German and it's being translated. And this is used again and again later on, and I believe the first one Tom took off the table in Glorious Bastards pays a debt to Judgment in Nuremberg. And Judgment in Nuremberg does so many beautiful things with language. I'm watching it. It's 3.5 hours long, and my family's in town, so I'm watching it in installments. But I'm falling for this film again I thought it was going to be a chore to watch it, and there's so many beautiful language moments in it, lovely little things like when Richard Widmark says something about the gemütlich charm of the area, but he doesn't explain what that word means, or when Marlene Dietrich says she's describing a title to Spencer Tracy, and she says, "I wish you understood German. The words are much sadder." And I think that's a lesson, that's sort of a message to us. We wish we could watch this film in German because the words might be sadder for us, but the reality is we can't. And this film does so many beautiful things with language, but that shift that shift resonates for years as far as film is concerned.
Well, they ripped it off from 13th Warrior, it sounds like.
That's true. That's true, because Hitler had a time machine that he got from Indiana Jones.
Spoiler.
Kelly Wand, have you seen Judgment at Nuremberg?
Yeah, it's awesome. I agree with Dingus.
I about fell asleep listening to Dingus Ta, all due respect. Oh my God, it's
not a documentary, fool.
I know. All right, I just think like Holocaust.
You don't see anything made. That's not what it is, though.
Exactly. A Holocaust courtroom movie that ripped off 13th Warrior.
Because there's only 12 people in a jury. Is that your issue?
But, see, Tom, I know you fell asleep for hearing me describe it, but it's good. It's
no. Hearing you talk about that twist was cool, but nothing you said about the movie makes me think I want to see a movie about the trials at Nuremberg with Maximilian Schell.
That's because you're a racist.
Spencer Tracy. I wouldn't know Spencer Tracy if he came up and kicked
what?
Me.
What? Really?
Yeah. Spencer Tracy.
Hey, you're on a movie podcast right now.
But that's how I felt putting it in. You know, I found the scene I'm talking about on YouTube, and I watched it, and I thought, well, I can just get away with this. Because I thought about this scene because it calls back a scene from another film that's one of my runners-up. And I went ahead and put the DVD in, and I am stunned at how good it is, how great Spencer Tracy is, and how wonderful the relationship is between, and how great Burt Lancaster is. He's freaking so
listen to
so
Tom.
Much dignity, and he's so great.
That old guy.
What's weird is the moment I'm talking about, the actual language shift moment, is a lovely moment, but it's sort of clunky for us as far as the just using a zoom in that way. But it just streamlines the process of the entire film, and it works. And the way they're using the headsets, you know, if you can imagine those UN headsets and everything, it's just such a great way to get around the language difficulties of this, and it's a wonderful way to solve a problem.
Well, that's why they did it in 13th Warrior before.
Good point.
Tom hates black and white movies.
You know, I think to how enamored I have been recently of Virgin Spring and Sunset Boulevard, and maybe it'll
and
be like one
Dance.
Of those. And when I finally see Gunga Din, I might even enjoy that.
Spencer Tracy pones William Holden, and so does Burt Lancaster.
Burt Lancaster, I think of the old guy in Atlantic City, that movie where Susan Sarandon rubs the lemon juice on her breasts.
Well, that's a good thing to think about.
And Montgomery Clift is fascinating.
Oh, good Lord, I don't even know who that guy is.
Oh, my God.
Wait, wasn't he on TV show, like Simon and Simon? Isn't he from that?
He's in the Liz Taylor movie, Sun something. Death in the Sun.
Yeah, I'm so out of my
head. Awesome. Young Liz Taylor.
The sun also.
Before she kind of looked mannish, like the really big.
All right, well, that's my number one.
All right, that's a good one, Dingus. That's wow.
Tom really likes it. He only likes World War II when it's in a game. He doesn't care about the actual events or actors, or he only likes video game voice actors. Okay.
This movie was probably shot, like, when is this movie from? Like, 19, probably it was shot in the 30s? This was probably in the 30s, right?
Yeah, it was shot before World War II, totally.
61.
I had a great instance of Dingus trying to convince me that Casablanca was shot in the 30s. And I still am not sure, Dingus, whether or not you actually believed that or you were griefing me.
Well, it does refer to the Spanish. Oh, yeah, you guys are dumb.
Well, there's that. All right, let me do my number one. You guys ready for this?
I forgot there were Nazis in Casablanca for a minute. Spoiler alert.
My number one is a little seen film. I can't imagine you would know that I would pick this one, Dingus. And it's it's a romance between two characters from different cultures, and they both speak their own language, but they also speak English to each other some of the time. So the movie is constantly shifting between English, Japanese, and Thai. And it's a movie called Last Life in the Universe. It's a Thai movie. It's a Japanese actor, Asano Tadanobu, who's a fantastic Thai actress, whose name I'm not going to attempt. And it's about something happens in a city, and they have to get out of the city. They sort of have to flee, and they go to this country house, this rundown country house, and sort of fall in love. It's not a conventional romance. It's not a normal. It's not that kind of thing. It's very arty. But they have problems talking to each other because neither of them knows each other's language very well, and they both only know English a little bit. So when they first get there and they introduce themselves to each other, she says, hold on a minute, and she goes off, and the house is a mess. There's just junk everywhere. She's not a very neat person, and she digs into a bunch of stuff, and she pulls out a tape and puts it in the tape recorder, and it is a how to speak Japanese language tape, but for Thai people. So over the next part of the movie, there's this sort of aural tapestry going of Japanese and Thai, this sort of call and response like you get in a language tape. It's almost liturgical, that's playing over scenes of them in the house and interacting. And it's sort of it's almost like a tapestry. It's like a backdrop to how the movie is about them being from different cultures. And I love the sound, too, of that there's something very, and if we have any Thai listeners, I apologize, but there's something very sort of chattery and brittle about Thai in a different way than Japanese. So the texture of the way they speak to each other is very different. And then when they break out into English every now and then, but I love the interplay of their languages and how it goes back and forth throughout Last Life in the Universe. So that's my number one.
So you see that, but not...
It's not black and white. It is lovely, gorgeously shot color. Cinematographer's Christopher Doyle, who's done a lot of work with Wong Kar-wai. I know there's...
This is my favorite instance of language in this podcast.
Yeah, listening to Tom say
something. The Hong Kong fella, Wong Kar-wai? No, did I just...
That the cream of some young guy.
Shut up.
Ding Wei-ba from...
Racist.
It's true. Last Life in the Universe is not an old black and white movie. It's a very new... it's within the last 10 years, but it's Christopher Doyle.
Colorist.
It looks fantastic. And the actors are fantastic, and it's even got, I want to say surprise appearance, but if I say this, it won't be a surprise anymore. It's got an appearance of Takashi Miike, the Japanese sort of shock director, in the end, which I love.
It's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous film, and I wouldn't even have thought of this. That's great. But what's the exact scene you're talking about?
So the scene is when they first get to her house.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
she pops in the tape. But throughout the movie, there's language shifting. But it's how that then tape playing back and forth. Because normally you hear that kind of you've heard that tape as a backdrop before. You know, where somebody says, "Hi, how are you?" And then it repeats it in the other language. "I am fine today. How are you?" And then it repeats it in the other language. And it's got this call and response beats going for it. And you hear this in the background, but it's Japanese and Thai. And you don't as an English listener, you don't necessarily know any of what's being said. But the subtitles do every now and then highlight a little bit because the director plays with certain passages from that tape having meaning, one of which is saying, "I am home." You know, that's part of the back and forth, and that gets played on a lot, is that Kenji, who's the Japanese character, a lot of the movie is about how he's an expatriate and how he can't go back to Osaka and how he's kind of adrift and how he finds a home at this location with this girl.
What's the conflict? Describe the whole movie, please.
You know, I don't want to give it away, but it plays very much like the hero, the quiet gunfighter with a mysterious past movie. And now that I've told you that Takashi Miike appears, you can sort of imagine how it might unfold. I'll just go ahead and say this. It is also a fantastic instance of how a tattoo is character development.
Oh, God.
Why are you going, "Oh, God"? What?
Because it sounds like a 3x3 topic, but...
That's pretty.
Save for later, but you want to. You think it might not have never come up, so you're just.
Well, the thing is, it's kind of at times it's a very slow, arty movie, but it has great, great payoff if you're.
Tattoos are always character development, though, aren't they? I mean,
they can be throwaway, but this tattoo. I'm already saying way too much.
It's got so many beautiful images in it. It's just a film chock full of beautiful images.
I was just putting it on to watch that scene again, and there's a shot where it's just the whole house, it's so run down, and it's in the middle of it. Also, it's this beautiful portrait of Thailand as a place that is struggling to not be reclaimed by the jungle. And when they go to this house, it's so run down, and there's like just vines and trees everywhere. And there's this awesome moment where he's just sort of like walking around outside, standing there, and it's quiet, and coconuts start like falling out of the trees onto him. It's almost like being bombarded by that coconut artillery. But yeah, it's a gorgeous movie. So there you go. That's my number one, Last Life in the Universe.
It's a good title.
It is a good title, isn't it? Yeah. So Kelly won.
In English. Oh.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I can't say it in Thai or Japanese. And because it's such a multilingual movie, I think it was released like with an English title. There's so much English in it already. All right, Kelly Wand, what is our 3x3 for next week? What do you got for us?
Just want to say all mine were one word titles.
Oh wait.
Hold on. Do we need to do runners up?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, runners up. Yeah. One of my runners up, we're still recording, Hunt for Red October, which was also John McTiernan, like Die Hard and 13th Warrior, but it's like that part where they like pan through the Russian submarine and then they just stop talking Russian and go into English so we don't have to like deal with Russian subtitles for the movie.
Wait, how do they do that? What's the gimmick?
It's a shot. It's like a slow pan, like one of those Frankenheimer shots from Manchurian Candidate. Then they just talk. It's from one line to the next, if I remember right. It's been a long time since I've seen it.
They just randomly start speaking English?
No. Actually, I hate to do this to Kelly, but this is the exact movie I was thinking of when I was talking about Judgment at Nuremberg, because it's a specific moment. It's when the political officer from the ship comes to talk to Sean Connery's Ramius. And they're having a conversation, and the political officer from the ship is asking him about what he's been reading. And he says, "A man like you reading about the end of the world." And the camera zooms in on his mouth as he says the word Armageddon. And then it comes back out from his mouth, and then they can speak in English. And we're saved from Sean Connery pretending Russian. It's a very specific moment, and it's...
You're sure about this, because you sound totally certain, 100%.
Oh, yes, and that's one of the reasons why I picked Judgment at Nuremberg, because I think I remember from this time, is that McTiernan took this from Stanley Kramer. It's the two of them having a scene in Russian, and the political officer says, "A man like you reading about the end of the world," and then he starts to read this text that Ramius is reading, and on the word Armageddon, the camera's on his lips, and it comes back out, and they speak English.
But wait a minute, Stanley Kramer stole that from John McTiernan in the 13th Warrior, though.
Exactly. So it all comes back to roost.
All right.
Delightful.
Did you guys think of Brad Pitt in Snatch?
No, I never do.
Is that even a
That's not a shift, though. That's just the way he talks.
Hey, that's a good point. Yeah. He's got that weird, whatever, that British Isles argot or whatever's going on there. Yeah.
No, but I did think of William Shatner in Star Trek III.
What?
When?
he apes Krug's Klingon word for... Beam me up. I don't know. He's talking to this guy on the Klingon ship named Maltz, and the planet is
Maltz.
falling
into our fear.
Maltz. There's a Klingon named Maltz.
I don't know.
Is there one named Hops?
Did George Lucas write that one? JK.
Yeast. He says, I don't know, activate the sensor beam, or I don't know what he says, but he says it in Klingon. It's like Jo Cha. Or Joe Troll or something. Something in
the listeners will tell us.
So that he can be beamed up to the ship after he's killed.
Oh, right. I remember now, yeah.
Oh, he spoofs the Klingon system, like he spoofs their communication system.
They didn't think he would know Klingon.
And he gets in there and he goes like pawn far or whatever, and they beam him up. He figured it out.
Doesn't even overhear it. Like, he doesn't even know it, even though he's supposed to be this awesome admiral. Like, doesn't he hear them say it before that?
Yeah, yeah. And he just and what's great about that, and I didn't realize this, is William Shatner is in Judgment at Nuremberg.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
They ripped that off then from Star Trek 3. Wow.
And they were all mimes.
That great
Don't
movie.
Be a mime. Jacobson brought a mime.
I had that line written. That's messed up.
See, they can't say the F word because it's PG-13. So the whole
right.
Also, Return of the Jedi, when C-3PO says R2 Daytoa, and he's conjugating. He's talking in Huttese.
How rude.
Yeah. Oh, good. That's pretty spot on.
Thank you. I can hold my own with you Star Trek dorks. Or Star Wars dorks.
Totally different. What about when people call the characters from a movie by the movie? Like, yeah, remember the Star Wars?
The titular line, you mean?
sexist. All right. Any more runners up?
That's just me.
No, that doesn't. Wow. I flirted with Henry V for a minute, but I let that go.
Who's he?
He's one of my friends. Oh, what?
All right, Kelly, what do you got for us for next week? What's our next 3x3? I can't wait to hear this. Is it a good one?
I think so. No, it's not.
Well, we'll be the judge of that, won't we?
Yep.
I have a good one 3 weeks from now when I'll be dead. Three best
how many
uses.
Systems?
10 star systems. Got the death mark. Wait. 12 systems. What is it? Forget all the Lucas numbers.
On par.
I feel bad for people listening to this.
I feel bad for us.
Yeah. Right, Kelly, what is your 3x3?
You had to struggle so hard to get to this wretched anticlimax. All right. Three best uses, and this is based on a conversation we had after the podcast, which is usually better than the podcast. Three best uses of lava in movies.
Crap,
and I'm taking Volcano off the table. Which one?
Star Trek 3.
Oh, yeah. That's not real lava, though, because it was from another planet, so the composition might not have been the same. So that's off the table. Also, Volcano's off the table, just because it's...
Volcanoes are off the table?
No, the movie Volcano, because it ends with where that part where they have all the ash, and they go, wow, black people, white people look the same with ash on their face. I didn't realize that. We all
Mount St. Helens one with Pierce Brosnan?
That's Dante's Peak. That's on the table.
Okay.
You're just killing me. You're taking every... Oh, Jesus.
This is a hard one. This is to make us work a little. I think we've been having it too easy.
All right, three best uses of lava next week. I don't think the movie we're seeing next week will have any lava in it. So,
do you like this topic? No, we'll find out.
We will
I
find
out. That's the cliffhanger. Does everyone hate the topic?
All right, so there you have it. Next week's 3x3, three best uses of lava. Next week we're going to see Step Up 3D for our movie.
Yeah.
Either that
Finally,
or the...
Good.
See, I'll go on record as saying I would have seen that. These guys didn't want to.
What?
Well, Dingus didn't want to. Actually, here's what the deal is. Here's what the deal is. Me and Kelly Wand are more than happy to go together and see Step Up 3D with each other. Just two dudes. We
holding hands.
Full enough
naked.
In our masculinity to do that. Exactly.
Yeah.
We do that. Dingus felt uncomfortable. So we deferred to him, and instead we're going to go see an art house film that I know nothing about called Winter's Bone.
It's
from the woman who did, is it Frozen Lake? Frozen River. The Melissa Leo movie, Frozen River, right.
By Safa.
And all, no. So instead of Step Up 3D, instead of the other guys, we're going to see an art house movie next week. Join us.
Oh, yeah, the other guys.
We'll be here to discuss Winter's Bone, and these actually go together very well. Winter's Bone and Three Best Uses of Lava. A little cold, a little hot. There you go.
Get it? Yeah. Thanks, James Cameron.
I am Tom Chick. I have been joined by Christian Marlboro? Is that right? Christian?
I am the Murawski man.
I was so close. And also Kelly Wand.
If you enjoyed this podcast, you're an idiot.
I can't sail my yacht. He's taken everything I got. All I've got's this sunny afternoon. Save me, save me, save me from this squeeze. I got a big fat mama trying to
nice knowing you, buddy.